Thanks very much, Vajratara. Very good to be back in Sheffield again. And the title of the talk is Open Up the Thatch. Open Up the Thatch. So the Buddha, both before and after his enlightenment, lived the life of a wandering ascetic. He was a shramana, to use the ancient Indian term, a bhikkhu, meaning one who has a share in alms food. He had no fixed abode, and he moved from place to place. He had very, very few possessions, just his three robes, a bowl, and just one or two bits and pieces, and no place to call his own. After his enlightenment, as before his enlightenment, he moved from place to place to teach, to communicate the Dharma that he'd discovered. And in time, a thriving community of disciples developed. A Sangha developed, and some of those disciples were enlightened as the Buddha was himself. They were his Arahant disciples. And many of these disciples, like him, were wanderers. Like him, they were shramanas. Like him, they were bhikshus. I said that they wandered from place to place, but there was one time of the year when they stayed in one place. This was for the 4 months of the rainy season. For the 4 month of the rains, a very wonderful time, the rainy season, when there's just these sheets of rain pouring down, very warm rain. During that time, they would all go into retreat together. Well, often in groups, sometimes solitary, but more often than not in groups. And they just spend their time meditating, spend their time meeting with each other, practicing the Dharma more intensively, perhaps, than when they were wandering. And the story I want to explore probably occurred during one of these rainy season retreats, because it takes place in an area of parkland that had been donated to the Buddha and his wandering disciples, near to the great city of Shravasti. Those of you who are interested, that is near the modern-day Lucknow in Uttar Pradesh. And we know that the Buddha spent 20 rainy seasons near the great city of Shravasti in retreat. And this particular story that I'm going to relate to you is taken from an ancient Pali collection, a very old Pali collection called the Udana. And Udana means verses of uplift, or verse of uplift, because each sutta, each story, each incident that occurs in the text concludes with the Buddha speaking spontaneously, as it were, a short, inspired verse, usually a very pithy verse, sometimes a rather cryptic verse. Udana literally means upward moving breath. Upward moving breath. Not the outgoing breath, that's a different thing. It's the upward moving breath. And Udana is also a verse, it's poetry. So really it's something spoken from the full force of inspiration, from the breath moving up, moving out. The breath being used here is a metaphor. So the Buddha sees something or something happens, something occurs to him, something goes on in the Sangha, something goes on in everyday life, or he has a profound meditation, and he feels moved to speak in verse, in poetry. And the story we're going to be looking at is quite a long story, with quite a long teaching in it, and the Udana verse is in fact very short, very pithy indeed, and rather cryptic, even sort of paradoxical. And the story tells of an Uposatha day. Uposatha means something like observance, an observance day. And these days happen twice a month. They happened on the new moon day and the full moon day. And on these days, all the wandering ascetics, all the wandering disciples of the Buddha, would come together for the whole night. They'd come together to confess their faults, and then to recite or to hear recited what's called the Pratimoksha, the Pratimoksha, which could be translated as that which leads to liberation. It's an interesting word. In time, this term Pratimoksha came to be the term for the set of precepts that you would observe as a monk or whatever status you had within the Buddhist Sangha. But originally, Pratimoksha was probably a sort of essential summary of the Buddha's teaching that the monks recited together. They think the original Pratimoksha was the very famous verse that goes, cease to do evil, cultivate the good, purify the heart. This is the ordinance. This is the sasana of all the Buddhas. That you could boil the Buddha's teaching down to that essential summary. And some people think that this is the original Pratimoksha. After the recitation of the Pratimoksha, there would be a Dharma discourse, a Dharma teaching. And as well, during that all-night session, the disciples would sit in silence together, meditating. They would be entering what is known as the Aryan silence, the noble silence. And this isn't just a silence in which there is no speaking, it's a silence of the mind. It's said that the Aryan silence begins when you enter the second dhyana, the second superconscious state, because in that state there are no discursive thoughts. So that was the aim of the sitting together on the Uposatha day. These Uposatha days are the origin of what we call in the Western Buddhist order days or order weekends. What we do on these days is, or these weekends, the order members, the members of the Western Buddhist order in an area or a region or indeed in a country, come together, as many of them come together as possible, and they share their experience. They come together to practice the Dharma, to study the Dharma, to listen to the Dharma. They might not stay up all night, but they'll certainly gather together for a day or a couple of days. So the origins of those order days and order weekends go right back to the earliest phase of Buddhism. Very important for the spiritual health of the Sangha, the spiritual community, to come together with others, to come together on the basis of their common commitment to the Dharma, to Buddhist practice. These sorts of days, these sorts of times are opportunities whereby we can take stock of ourselves. We can look at ourselves. We can open up to one another about any faults that we may have committed, any kind of breaches of the basic Buddhist precepts, and renew our spiritual commitment, our commitment to the Dharma, as well as being roused and instructed in the Dharma by spiritual friends. And you're refreshed through the support of the Sangha. This is what should really be happening on these kinds of days. Perhaps Sangha night, Tuesday night at the Sheffield Buddhist Centre has something of this quality, especially after Christmas and New Year festivities. It's the coming together of the Sangha in Sheffield, the wider Sangha in Sheffield, Sangha night. And it's a very good, I've experienced this Sangha night quite a few times, and yeah, it's a very good way in which I think the Sangha comes together in Sangha. Maybe over Christmas and the New Year, we haven't practiced as we usually do. What with family, friends, food, drink, telly, partying, monopoly, and so on. So the first Sangha night of the year is a chance to take stock. Perhaps it's an opportunity to where we might have to admit that we perhaps have let our spiritual practice slip a little bit, and a chance to refresh and renew our connection with the Sangha, with the Dharma, and indeed with the Buddha, and make a fresh and inspired start to the year. Anyway, on the particular Uposatha day in question that I'm going to be talking about, the Buddha was seated surrounded by the Sangha, by the order, by the bhikkhus, by the wanderers. They were in some kind of thatched hall, probably made of wood, in this parkland. And they were sitting in silence, and they were sitting in silence for some time, for some hours. For the first watch of the night. You know, the sun had gone down and they were sitting there in the darkness with just the oil lamps glowing. And Ananda, the Buddha's close friend and companion and attendant, comes to the Buddha and says, the monks are all gathered, the bhikkhus are all gathered, they're ready, they're waiting. They're waiting for you to recite the Pratimoksha, the essential teaching. Please do this. But the Buddha remained completely silent, just sitting there. And this happened twice more throughout the night, throughout the whole night. Twice, a few hours later, Ananda got up and asked the Buddha to recite the Pratimoksha. And then again, a few hours later, asked him again to recite the Pratimoksha. And each time, the Buddha remained completely silent. So with the third time, with the dawn beginning to break, as the idiom, the Pali idiom has it, as the night shows a face of gladness, Ananda asks again. He says, Lord, the monks have been sitting for a long time. They've been sitting all night. They're waiting, waiting for you to recite the Pratimoksha. And the Buddha said very simply, very directly, Ananda, the gathering is not completely pure. The gathering is not completely pure. So you can imagine the atmosphere. You know, they've all been sitting there in complete silence. They knew something strange must have been going on because the Buddha will not speak. And then at the end of the night he says, Ananda, the gathering is not completely pure. There's no explanation, he just says it. And one of his disciples, an enlightened disciple, an arahant named Mahamoggallana, who was famous for his ruddhis, his psychic powers, his powers of being able to see beyond the surface of things, looked around the gathering. And he saw in that gathering one of those present who was not pure. He saw who it was. He saw someone there who, although wearing the patched robes of a wanderer, actually was living a very, very different life. He was, in fact, leading a highly unskillful life. He wasn't following a spiritual life at all, although he was pretending to do so. His monk life, his wandering life, was a sham, a show. So Mahamoggallana, as soon as he saw this, went to this monk, this sham monk, and said, come friend, you are seen by the Buddha. Come friend, you are seen by the Buddha. And three times he had to say this. Three times. And there was no response from this man. And in the end, Mahamoggallana had to take him by the arm and remove him from the gathering. Open the door of the hall and just put him out and then lock the door. And then he returned telling the Buddha that the gathering was now pure. Well, we'll look at the Buddha's response to this in a moment, but first let's consider what's happened because it's pretty sensational. And the story so far might be a little shocking to some of you. The Buddha, after all, is so kindly and compassionate, and presumably because of that, really easygoing. So it seems rather strange. He seems rather strange, even stern, in this story. And the Arahant Moggallana seems pretty tough, physically removing someone from the gathering. You don't get the impression there's a punch up or anything like that. I mean, they wouldn't do that because they're proper Buddhists. He just, you know, just takes him by the arm and shows him the door. The Buddha remains silent all night long. Let's just look at this. He sees that the Sangha, the gathering, is impure, but he says nothing until the sun begins to rise. Wouldn't it have been better if he'd spoken earlier? And why can't he recite the teaching? Maybe that would have helped matters. Maybe it would have helped with that monk. But the Buddha is silent for so long because he wants the monk, this very unskillful monk, to take the initiative. To take the initiative. He's giving him the opportunity to be honest, to be upfront. He wants him to see what is happening. He wants him to see his state. He wants to see what he's done and what he's doing. He wants him to recognize his spiritual state. He wants, in other words, the monk, the sham monk, to take responsibility for himself, for his actions and for his mental states. The Buddha's silence is throwing the monk, let's call him the bad monk, for want of a better way of putting it, back upon himself. The Buddha is also throwing all the disciples, all his disciples, the whole Sangha, back on themselves. The whole Sangha, his silence and his cryptic comment, the gathering is not completely pure, is asking the Sangha, his disciples, to take responsibility for a problem which is amongst them. The problem of someone who is only pretending to lead a wandering life, a spiritual life, but isn't really doing it at all, but who wants all the benefits of that life. He wants perhaps a good standing in society, free food. After all, you get free food if you're a monk. And the company and the lodgings of the monks and so on. This is something that did happen even in the Buddha's day, especially as the Sangha became more established. In the end, Mahamoggallana has to eject the false monk. It really shows how far the monk has fallen away from the spiritual life. Because even at this point he could have changed the situation. Of course he could have. By acknowledging, by confessing his faults. He could have turned it around. He could have found a way of getting back into communication. That is what the Buddha and Mahamoggallana want him to do. They want him to acknowledge, to open up, to reveal, yes, to confess, in the sense of admit his failings. That's all they want. But the monk cannot do that. We're not told why. In fact, we're not really told very much about him at all, apart from how unskillful he was. But we can surmise that he had reached a point where his pride, his conceit, prevented him from opening up to his spiritual friends. He had turned people who were his spiritual friends, who had been his spiritual friends, the Buddha and the other disciples, into authority figures, people to fit in with, people to fear, rather than what they actually were, spiritual companions and spiritual friends who you join with in spiritual friendship. Of course, this is something we can fall into ourselves. None of us are perfect spiritual practitioners. Of course we're not. We make efforts, but we also make mistakes. We do silly things. We do unskillful things. We break the precepts. We miss meditations. We have bad habits, which have the annoying habit of repeating themselves, even with our best efforts. Of course that happens. And there can be a temptation to hide all that away from our spiritual friends, from the Sangha. Because if they found out about us, they wouldn't like us. And even to go so far as to pretend that we're really very spiritual and convince others in the Sangha of how spiritual we are. If we feel really bad about ourselves, we might even turn others in the Sangha, in the spiritual community, into authority figures. We can really turn them into real sort of power figures and get very frightened of their disapproval. And of course, as soon as you do that, you start hating them. Because if you're frightened of somebody, well, you turn them into somebody who you really don't like at all. You miss a meditation or three, you start to sort of feel, they think I'm really bad. You might even, reacting against that, think, well, I'm better than any of them, really. What do they know? But the way to cut through all this is very simple. The way to cut through this, all this confusion, is to open. To acknowledge, to admit, yes, to confess faults. That's the way to deal with it. That's the way to cut through all this confusion, all this nonsense. is just to meet up with a spiritual friend and just tell them what's going on. Just tell them what's happening. Whatever's happening, just tell them. If they're a true spiritual friend, a real spiritual friend, they will listen well. They'll be kind in their response and they'll point a way forward for you. And very often, I think, at the root of all these problems, particularly this failure to open up, is very often lack of confidence, not feeling good enough. I mean, in my time in our Sangha, and I've been around quite a long time in our Sangha, I haven't come across many people who do really bad things. I mean, sometimes people have come to me and they say, if I tell you, what I've done, you really won't like me and you'll be really shocked. And I say, well, come on, tell me, And eventually do it, and it's nothing. It's nothing. It might even have just been things they were thinking. It's not actually something they've actually done. And very often there can be, as I say, this lack of confidence, this feeling, I'm not good enough to be part of the Sangha. I'm not a good enough Buddhist to be part of the Sangha. That's another reason why we can sort of hide and not open up to one another. I remember when I first moved to Padmaloka, this retreat centre where I live, I joined a group of men who were called the ordination team. And this was a team of people, it still exists, I'm still part of it. It's changed a lot over the years, but I joined it in its very early days. And it was the beginning of us developing a training process for men who'd asked for ordination, who wanted to join our order. And it was a big deal to be part of that team in those days, because it was the early days of it. And we do all these retreats and so on, and people would really look to us and so on. And then every few months or so we'd have these big meetings of our team. There was about five of us in the team, and we'd meet over a week and we'd spend quite a bit of time just talking about our experience of what we were doing and how it related to our personal spiritual practice. And one of the things that was really amusing was that one of us would start off, reporting in, as we call it, giving an account of how we were getting on, and say, well, I've realised something, these last months, and realised something being with you. I've realised that I'm the weak link in the team. I'm the worst person here. My practice is weak. I'm not very good at study. I feel really not very good at communicating the Dharma to people, and so on and so forth. And they'd be going on like that, and the person next to them would say, no, I'm the weak link. And then somebody else would say, no, I am. And then in the end, it'd almost be a punch up on who was the weak link. And it was really rather relieving, because we all felt the same way. We all felt, in a way, not good enough. And we realised, well, actually, thinking like that was really rather silly. But the fact that we opened up about it, got it all into perspective, put all that into perspective, you could work out what was lack of confidence and where there really needed to be real work. But the practice was opening up, which that poor, unfortunate monk didn't do. Hopefully, maybe, later on he did open up, we don't know. In the end, in a way, it doesn't really matter how rough and ready we are as Buddhist practitioners. As long as we are honest about ourselves, as long as we're considerate to other people and truthful with other people, and trying our very best, making every effort we can to practice the Dharma. That's all that the Buddha and the Sangha asks of us. We're not asked to move to immediate perfection, but we're asked to commit ourselves wholeheartedly to spiritual practice, to make effort, to be as honest as possible, and to be as considerate to other people as we can. It's not really a lot to ask, or maybe. So if you have that among those gathered in a Sangha, then you can really communicate the Dharma. If you've got that, if you've got people who are honest and committed and considerate, then you can really start communicating the truth to them. The Buddha could not speak to the gathering because there was someone that was at odds with the spirit of the Dharma. There was dishonesty and falseness, something, as it were, not clean in the sense of not being straightforward in that assembly. So when you've got that, it's very difficult. It's impossible to explore the Dharma in such an atmosphere. You've probably experienced that. You know, if a friend or a work colleague or somebody says, well, tell me about Buddhism. And you try, and they're not really interested. And the atmosphere is all wrong. You just can't do it. It doesn't matter what you say. It's not going to go in. And ourselves, we want the Dharma. We want maybe the special teaching that will change our lives from the enlightened master. But very often we're not in a fit state to receive it, to hear it. Even if it was being told loud and proud by fantastic spiritual friends, we wouldn't hear it, we wouldn't get it, because we're not in a state in which we can take it in. Very often, to really hear the Dharma, to really learn the Dharma, the 95% of the work is to get into the state in which you can receive it. Anyway, after the false monk had left or been shown the door, the Buddha then felt able to teach. I say teach, but we should have more the sense of him just talking, just communicating. He wouldn't have been standing behind a lectern. He would have just been sitting there with his disciples, and he just starts to talk, perhaps in quite an intimate kind of way, speaking warmly and clearly. And he began talking immediately. Immediately the assembly was purified, he could talk. He obviously felt the atmosphere was right. And he began to speak about something very strange and very mysterious. He began to speak about the great and mighty ocean. The great and mighty ocean. I say that it's something strange and mysterious because the Buddha and his disciples lived very far from the ocean. All they would have known of the ocean were travellers' tales and myths and stories about this vast, seemingly endless body of water, far greater than the great rivers of northern India, far greater than the Ganges. They would have known that, but they would not have known the ocean. They would have just been these reports of this great ocean. And in particular, the Buddha spoke of 8 wonderful and marvellous qualities of the great and mighty ocean, which the Asuras, the Titans, delighted in. So these 8 qualities reflect very much the lore of the time. You'll find a lot of fault with it if you just even have a smattering of marine biology, but that's not the point. So let's just go through the 8 wonderful and marvellous qualities of the great and mighty ocean. The great ocean goes down gradually. It gradually shelves and slopes and inclines. You don't go down into it suddenly. You go down into it gradually. Secondly, the great ocean is stable. It doesn't overflow its boundaries. It doesn't overflow its tide line. Thirdly, the great ocean does not tolerate a dead body. It throws it up onto the shore. Fourthly, all of the rivers that flow into the great ocean, the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Achiravati, the Sarabu, the Mahi, all lose their individual names and identities on entering the ocean and become known as the great and mighty ocean. Fifthly, although rivers flow into the ocean, and although rain fills it from the sky, the volume of water remains the same. The great ocean doesn't grow less, doesn't grow more. Yes, you can see it's a bit different from the findings of science, but never mind. Sixthly, the great ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. Wherever you go, it tastes of salt. Seventhly, the great ocean contains many precious gems and substances. It contains pearls, crystal, beryl, quartz, coral, gold, silver, ruby, cat's eye. Eighthly, the great and mighty ocean is the abode of mighty creatures. Leviathan, fish eater, nagas, asuras, gandharvas. These are huge creatures, vast creatures, as you can see. The Buddha was no marine biologist. So the Buddha evoked for the monks the eight wonderful and marvellous qualities of the great and mighty ocean. So we have to imagine how this must have been to these disciples. The Buddha was a good storyteller, and the monks were probably enchanted by the evocation of the ocean, sitting there with the dawn coming on in this great park in the rainy season. He's talking about the ocean, this wonderful thing, this great and mighty ocean. And then the Buddha went further. He began to liken the Dharma, his teaching, to this great and mighty ocean. He spoke of, well, not just the Dharma, what's called the Dharma Vinaya. The Dharma Vinaya, the Dharma meaning something like the principle, and Vinaya meaning the practice. So the principle of the truth, the teaching, and its application, its working out in life. Dharma Vinaya. So the Dharma Vinaya is like the great and mighty ocean. It is vast, mysterious, strange, deep, unfathomable. It's very important to remember this. We can so easily turn the Dharma into an ordinary object of knowledge, like physics or history or whatever. We study it a bit. We get a bit of knowledge. We feel as though we've done Buddhism. Because we've done Buddhism, we feel, as it were, superior to Buddhism, superior to the Dharma. We've had that phase. We've mastered it. Or we do it a bit of Buddhism, and then we get bored with it, so we discard it. But if that's our attitude, we've not really encountered the Dharma Vinaya at all, not in the sense in which the Buddha is speaking of it. The Dharma Vinaya cannot be reduced to a set of ideas or even to a set of practices. Dharma can mean truth. It can mean the way things are. It can mean reality. And as such, there's no end to the Dharma. It's infinitely deep. It's boundless. And the more you go into it, the more you practice it, the more you study it, the more you reflect on it, the more you live it, the more you go into it, you have a greater sense, an even greater sense, of how vast and deep and mysterious it is. I've been practicing the Dharma for over 30 years now, and I tell you, I still feel as though I'm a beginner, very much a beginner at the Dharma. It just seems to get deeper and deeper the more I go on with it. So really, as we go deeper into the Dharma, what starts to arise is a sense of reverence and awe, as when you look out onto the great ocean and you sense its depths, its mysteries, its endlessness, its beauty, its ever-changing colours, its strength, its power even. When you look at the ocean, if you're in the ocean on a little boat, well, you know there's no way you can master this. There's no way you can own this. You just have to sort of, you know, live in it and be in it. When you really begin living the Buddhist life, it's not so much about practicing something. It's actually more of a sense of moving into this vast and mysterious realm of the Dharma, the ocean of the Dharma, and discovering its wonders, its mysteries, its riches. The Buddha himself, on this occasion, just mentions just eight qualities in his own discourse. Eight wonderful and marvellous qualities, which are the same as those of the great and mighty ocean. So let's look at these one by one. So in the same way that the ocean gradually shelves and slopes downward, in the Dharma Vinaya, the principle and the practice, the truth and its application, there is a gradual training, a gradual course, a gradual progression. There is no sudden penetration to final knowledge. So the Buddhist path is a gradual path. You don't suddenly jump straight to Nirvana. One doesn't suddenly wake up It might seem like that time, but sometimes you might suddenly see something or suddenly have a really good meditation or whatever. But according to the Buddha, there is always a leading up to that. There's always a build up to that sort of breakthrough, to that sort of insight. In other words, spiritual life, spiritual experience, insight, wisdom, enlightenment is dependent on conditions. If we want success in meditation, we need to practice regularly and daily. We need to go on retreat from time to time. We also need to simplify our life. Our meditation is dependent upon those conditions. We need to practice the precepts, practice Buddhist ethics. Meditation is dependent on a really good practice of Buddhist ethics. If we want wisdom and insight to develop, we will need to dwell in deep meditation. We will need to dwell in what's known as dhyana, absorption. We'll need to concentrate and purify the mind so that we can see, without distraction, without bias, the way things really are. So the Buddhist path is a path of gradual unfolding. Morality, meditation, wisdom. It's a path of gradual unfolding, and we need to apply ourselves to a steady and regular training. It's much better to establish a steady, regular spiritual practice and gradually unfold than engaging in intense bursts and then stopping. I mean, I've seen it sometimes, people doing intensive retreats, meditating round the clock, and then going off on a bender, and then sort of wondering why there's such a sort of, what's wrong, you know, why they feel as though they're going bonkers. Well, they need to develop a regular life. It's much better to just do a little bit, and regularly, than a lot, occasionally. So this is the first wonderful and marvellous quality of the Dharma Vinaya. It's a gradual training, a gradual progression. Secondly, the second quality, in the same way that the ocean remains stable and does not overflow its tide line, in the same way the disciples of the Buddha do not transgress the precepts even for the sake of their lives. This is what the Buddha says. My disciples don't transgress the precepts even for the sake of their lives. Very strong language here. What the Buddha, of course, means is that a true disciple of the Buddha keeps the precepts perfectly. Obviously, this is an ideal for us, something we're aiming for. The precepts, the 5 precepts or the 10 precepts that order members observe are sikkhapada, which means something like places of training. They're things we're training in to reach a point where our life is a perfect expression of the precepts. To reach a point, for example, we train in the first precept so that we can reach the point of perfection, which is always acting with loving kindness. So in a way, practicing the precepts, training in the precepts, means that we're training to be a true disciple of the Buddha. We want to get to that point where we never transgress the precepts. But the important thing is to train in the precepts and to regard yourself as being in training in order to be a true disciple, so that you can sit, as it were, close to, near to the Buddha. The third wonderful and marvellous quality of the Dharma Vinaya is, in the same way that the ocean does not tolerate a dead body but throws it up onto the shore, in the same way the spiritual community does not tolerate someone who's not really practicing the Dharma, although they pretend to do so. The Buddha says, even though he may be sitting in the midst of the Sangha, yet he is far from the Sangha, and the Sangha is far from him. So this quality of the Dharma Vinaya goes back to the whole setting of the teaching. And we've already looked at the meaning of that in quite a bit of detail. What's interesting here are the Buddha's words. Even though he may be sitting in the midst of the Sangha, yet he is far from the Sangha, and the Sangha is far from him. This makes it clear that Sangha, spiritual community, is not about membership of some religious group. Sangha arises when a number of individuals come together to practice the Dharma Vinaya together in complete honesty, in complete openness, and in complete harmony with one another. When you have that, then you sit close, you sit near, you sit in the midst of the Sangha. If you're not really practicing the Dharma, if you're pretending to practice the Dharma, even if you're physically with the Sangha, you're not really in the Sangha at all. Now, the fourth wonderful and marvellous quality of the Dharma. In the same way that the four great rivers of India lose their names when they enter the great and mighty ocean, in the same way the followers of the four castes, the Brahmins, the priestly castes, the Kshatriyas or warriors, the Vaishyas or the merchants, and the Shudras or labourers, when they lose their caste names and identities when they enter the Sangha, the spiritual community, and are known as just sons of the Sakyam, meaning sons or daughters of the Buddha. So when we become part of the Buddhist Sangha, when we become truly part of it, through committing ourselves to the Buddhist path, we no longer identify ourselves according to any worldly conditioning. In India, the biggest conditioning of all is caste. It still is. And it runs very, very deep indeed. But the Buddha himself did not recognize that caste identity at all. He really is revolutionary in this respect, because he's the first spiritual teacher on the Indian scene who just will not accept caste. He won't accept an identity that you've been born into. Just wouldn't accept that at all. When you entered his Sangha, you had to stop your caste identity. You just were mixing with everybody else completely openly. Well, you were just followers of the Buddha. Well, we don't have caste over here. But there are such things as class, race, nationality, what region we come from, what sort of education we've had, what job we have, what age we are, what sexual orientation we have, or whatever the word is, and so on. There's so many ways in which we define ourselves. These are all group identities, and they're bound up with the values of the world, with the samsara. When you enter the Buddhist community, you let go of all that. Those identities have no place at all. Buddhist practice is about dissolving all those identities, freeing ourselves from narrow, imprisoning definitions of ourselves, wherever they derive from, and we begin to relate to others, to communicate with others in the same way, in an identity-less way. We look beyond identity and definition, and we start seeing the potential for unlimited spiritual development. This is really important. That's the way a Buddhist practitioner needs to relate to everyone, not in terms of previous identity, but in terms of their unlimited spiritual potential. And Buddhism, the Dharma Vinaya, places no limit at all on one's spiritual development. If you like, identity in Buddhism completely dissolves, because there's no limit placed on spiritual development. We have the potential for the attainment of nothing less than nirvana. Which brings us to the fifth wonderful and marvellous quality of the Dharma Vinaya. In the same way that the ocean remains stable, no matter what water flows into it from rivers or what rain falls from the sky, no matter how many people attain full and final nirvana, it makes no difference to nirvana. Nirvana doesn't grow bigger or smaller. Nirvana is never exhausted. In other words, nirvana, enlightenment, is not a thing, and it's not anybody's exclusive possession. It's not something that will run out. be used up. So we need to think, bringing it down a bit if you like, that happiness and well-being and spiritual attainment, we don't need to think that happiness and well-being and spiritual attainment will run out just because others are enjoying those things. So there's no need to be jealous of others when they make spiritual progress. I mean, they're not using up all the sort of nirvana that's around, or all the spiritual qualities that are around. They're not using up. There's no need to compete with them. Rejoice, because they're just creating the possibility for you. And nirvana, enlightenment, is always a possibility. It's always available in its fullness, providing we are dedicated to it. So that's the fifth wonderful quality. Nirvana remains the same, doesn't get used up. So the sixth wonderful and marvellous quality. In the same way that the great and mighty ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, in the same way the Dharma Vinaya, the teachings of the Buddha, have one taste, the taste of liberation. And the word here is vimutti, liberation, freedom, emancipation. Buddhist practice, if practiced properly, should be giving you the taste, the direct experience of liberation, of freedom. And liberation is explored very, very thoroughly in Buddhist tradition. There is, for example, citta vimoksha, the liberation of the heart, which consists in dwelling in love, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, the boundless state, the divine abidings. This is liberation because there is no boundary to the heart, to the mind in that state. There is nothing to imprison it in any way. So we are not imprisoned in any way when we're dwelling in loving kindness, when we're loving all beings. That is liberation. And such liberation is, of course, bliss, happiness. The Buddha speaks after describing his experience after enlightenment. He speaks of dwelling in the bliss of liberation for 7 weeks, multiples of 7 weeks. Seven is a magic number in Indian tradition. It means he's dwelling out of time. Time is something that imprisons us, that limits us. Well, the Buddha is in the bliss of timeless liberation. He's coming from that place. So if Buddhist practice isn't opening up some kind of liberation for us, some feeling of freedom, we need to ask ourselves why. What's lacking? Do we really understand what we're doing? Are we doing it properly? Are we really applying ourselves? Or are we actually aware of how much freedom we're gaining through our Buddhist practice? We need to ask those questions. The seventh wonderful and marvellous and mysterious quality, in the same way that the ocean is filled with precious gems, in the same way the Dharma Vinaya is filled with the jewels of teachings. It's filled with teachings like the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the Noble Eightfold Path, the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of enlightenment, and many, many more. The Buddha's Dharma is rich in teachings. You can't reduce the Buddha's teaching to just one neat set. It's very, very rich in teachings, because different teachings were developed for different individuals and for different times in their spiritual development. Different people need different approaches. Sometimes people say, of course, well, there's just too much in Buddhism. I don't know what to do. You just have to ask yourself, when you're engaging in a Buddhist practice, when you're studying a Buddhist practice, does this lead to liberation? How does this lead to liberation? Does it lead to nirvana? Are these teachings having this effect? That is the only criterion. Are they changing us? Are we changing through practicing them? And make the most of one or two of these teachings. It's really important to go into one or two teachings very, very thoroughly, very, very well. Study them, reflect on them, practice them, and then you really will see what jewels and what treasures and what riches they really are, riches that you enjoy. Eighthly, the eighth wonderful and mysterious and marvelous quality, in the same way that the great and mighty ocean is the abode of great creatures, great monsters, great giants of the deep, the Dharma Vinaya is the abode of great monsters of the deep. There are stream entrants, once returners, non-returners, arahants. In other words, there are those who are irreversible from nirvana and those who are further along that path of irreversibility, even up to enlightened disciples of the Buddha themselves, the arahants. We can also add other great characters from other Buddhist traditions. The Dharma Vinaya, the ocean of the Dharma, is filled with bodhisattvas, mahasiddhas, dharkas, dharkanis. The Dharma Vinaya is the abode of great spiritual monsters, those who've made substantial spiritual progress, irreversible spiritual progress. They swim around in the ocean of the Dharma, and if we plunge into the Dharma, we can actually meet them, we can swim with them, we can learn to swim from them, we can be inspired by them, we can even dance with them in the water, water ballet or something. Are we ready to take the plunge? So this is the Buddha's great teaching to his disciples on the Upasita day, talking about the ocean-like qualities of the Dharma Vinaya, the mysterious and wonderful qualities of the great and mighty Dharma and its practice, its application. And it's clear from this that the Dharma Vinaya for the Buddha wasn't just a set of teachings and rules, it's something vast and great, even something greater and bigger than him. In the eight qualities, he refers to the path, to aspects of the Sangha or spiritual community, to nirvana, to particular practices, to the experience of liberation, to great spiritual monsters. The Dharma Vinaya is in fact the ocean of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha in all their aspects. Having given this teaching, the Buddha is deeply moved by the whole occasion. He's deeply moved by the experience with the hypocritical monk and of the gathering in silence. He's deeply moved through his contemplation, his evocation of the ocean of the Dharma. And under the force of inspiration, he breathes forth, he sends forth this udana, this inspired saying. It rains through the thatch, not through the open. So open up the thatch, then it won't rain through. So remember, probably they're in a thatched hall. And he's probably looking around and he sees the thatched hall. It rains through the thatch, not through the open. So open up the thatch, then it won't rain through. Very strange, very cryptic. And no doubt it goes back to the incident with the bad monk. We think, so often we think, we can avoid pain and suffering by hiding our faults from others, by hiding our faults from ourselves. We cover them over, we cover them up, but sooner or later the truth will come out and we will get a soaking. The cold rain of reality will drench us to the bone. Much better then to not hide our faults and our failings and our lack of confidence and all the rest of it and our vulnerabilities. We just open. We just open up, obviously at the right time, at the right place, to people who will really understand. We open up to our spiritual friends, to the Sangha. But just open up and you won't get drenched by the rain. Instead, you will find yourself opening up to the great, the vast, the mighty ocean of the Dharma with all its wonderful and marvellous qualities. It rains through the thatch, not through the open. So open up the thatch, then it won't rain through. Thank you.